From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We're learning today that Attorney General Jeff Sessions will testify publicly before the Senate Intelligence Committee tomorrow afternoon as part of the committee's investigation of possible Trump campaign ties to Russia and election hacking. The president's daughter, Ivanka Trump, was on Fox News this morning and defended her father following fired FBI Director James Comey's congressional testimony last week.
Well, my father felt very vindicated in all the statements that he's been making and feels incredibly optimistic.
NPR Politics editor Domenico Montanaro joins us. Domenico, last week we heard from Comey. We heard from President Trump in a short press conference on Friday. Now we're going to hear from the attorney general tomorrow, who had at least a couple of undisclosed meetings with the Russian ambassador and then recused himself from the Russia investigation. He's going to testify. What do you expect?
Well, look, I mean, the fact is here, Sessions is in real jeopardy. He's facing pressure from both sides. You know, Trump is unhappy that he recused himself because that recusal, Trump believes, raised the stakes on Russia. And he's at risk of perjury. He's going to be under oath. And if he says something that's different than Comey, and Comey, you know, is also at risk if Comey said something that's not true. You know, Comey and Trump have said things that are opposite of each other now. Trump saying that Comey, accusing Comey of saying things that just weren't true. Somebody is lying here. And Trump said that he's willing to go under oath to testify. And frankly, I'm getting butterflies because I love the idea that in this murky story, we don't know the truth and people are having to go under oath to talk about it. Well, you know what? Sunshine is the best disinfectant.
Do you expect that Trump will end up testifying under oath?
I have no idea. I mean, he floated it on Friday that if that's something that Mueller wants, the special counsel, the former FBI director, then he would. But there's no reason to think that, you know, executive privilege won't be invoked in some ways or that he may rethink that. But I would love to see everybody go under oath in these situations because the truth is our North Star, and having people raise, you know, have that go that high. There's a very different Donald Trump that you see in public than the Trump that you see who's under oath. You know, if you've watched any of those depositions he's ever been on, he's very careful, he's very calm, and he's very careful to make sure that his words are accurate.
Meanwhile, what's happening to his agenda because of all of this? He tweeted over the weekend, quote, great numbers on the economy, all of our work, including the passage of many bills and regulation killing executive orders, now kicking in. But if you look at the big things, health care, tax reform, he hasn't been able to get those through Congress yet, even though his party controls both houses.
Right. They've certainly passed a bunch of regulations repeals that through the Congressional Review Act, which only affect basically the last 6 months of what President Obama has put through. And most of his agenda has been stalled. They did get the health care bill through Congress, or through the House, I should say. And the Senate is working on a companion version. It's not going through a committee. It's going through a working group that's going to try to get something done on that. That could come to the floor at some point this month. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wants to get something at least to the floor. Whether it passes or not is a different situation, but they want to get something to the floor so that they can get it off the table so they can then work on tax reform.
Today, the attorneys general for the District of Columbia and Maryland sued President Trump, accusing him of violating the Constitution's anti-corruption clauses. How serious is this lawsuit for the president?
Well, you know, I mean, they're sort of partisan complaints. Both people who filed are Democrats. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that they're meritless. This is something that now is like a first step to kind of get a lot of Trump's conflicts of interest heard in the court. Yeah, a lot of people have taken notice of the fact that the Trump Hotel that's now in downtown D.C. has had a lot of reflections on it at night. People saying things like bribes here and arrows pointing to the door. So this is something that is going to continue to gnaw at President Trump, especially considering that they're definitely his family is blurring the lines between the presidency and his businesses.
Just quickly, Domenico, voters in Puerto Rico over the weekend overwhelmingly voted for statehood in a non-binding referendum. Would Congress ever give them what they asked for?
Probably not. This election was pretty flawed. Congress has to admit them. Only 23% of the country voted in a country that usually about 80% of the country votes. 97% of the people who voted voted in favor of statehood, which says that potentially the opposition decided to stay home and not vote. That right. really undercuts the legitimacy of this vote.
That's Domenico Montanaro, NPR politics editor. Domenico, thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And this political news, in just this afternoon, the Montana congressman-elect who was charged with assaulting a reporter right before his special election has been sentenced. Republican Greg Gianforte will not serve jail time. He will serve 40 hours of community service, and he'll do 20 hours of anger management.
The primaries for the Virginia gubernatorial race are tomorrow. The sitting governor, Terry McAuliffe, is prohibited by law from running again, so there will definitely be a new governor. The question is, will November's election be a referendum on the national political scene? For a long time, the state was reliably red, but it's been trending blue in recent years. On the GOP side, the frontrunner is former chair of the Republican National Committee, Ed Gillespie, a bit of a known name. Here he is during a debate earlier this year.
I'm running for governor to create jobs, raise take-home pay, help people lift themselves out of poverty, and make sure that Virginia is always a place where the next generation can do better than the generation that came before us.
Patrick Madden is a reporter at Here Now, contributor WAMU. Patrick, start there. Sounds pretty by the book. You know, what more should we know about Gillespie?
Right. So, I mean, I think you kind of can hear that he wants to sort of stick to the bread and butter issues. He's running as this moderate, pro-business governor. He's really trying to, I think his opponents have actually called him no-show Ed because he's avoided some of the appearances and earlier debates. So I think he's really sort of hoping to win this primary without taking too many positions that will hurt him later in the general.
Well, one of Ed Gillespie's opponents on the GOP side in the primaries tomorrow is Corey Stewart. He made headlines over the weekend with an ad called Unhinged. It shows that image, much decried on both the right and the left, of comedian Kathy Griffin holding a bloody mask of President Trump's head. Let's listen to a little of that ad.
Donald Trump's the president, and unhinged liberals can't handle it. Who'll stop them? Ed Gillespie won't. Gillespie is a failed candidate, and anti-Trump K Street lobbyist who backs amnesty, is okay with late-term abortions, and liberal cities taking down Robert E. Lee and forcing transgender bathrooms.
So, Patrick, a local TV station initially refused to air that ad because of that Kathy Griffin image. They eventually gave in. But what does that ad say to you, the content, the
language? There's a lot going on in that ad.
Yeah.
You know, this is Corey Stewart is running as the outsider in this race. He's kind of trying to take a page from the Donald Trump playbook. So he's been doing pretty much anything that will make headlines, including this ad featuring the Kathy Griffin thing. He's also, as you sort of heard in that ad, embraced protecting Confederate memorials from being taken down. And he's also taken a really hard line on immigration. And all of this is trying to reach those hardcore primary voters, the Trump supporters in this race, to try to win this primary, not really thinking about, I don't think, the general election in November.
Yeah. Well, the race is a bit tighter on the Democratic side. It's between former Congressman Tom Perriello and the current Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam. Some people see this as having some similarities to the national Democratic primary in the presidential
right.
race last year. How so?
I think for a lot of Virginia voters, it really has that feel of 2016, where on one hand, you have Tom Perriello, and he's a former one-term congressman, but he really is the Bernie Sanders in this race, and in fact was endorsed by him and Elizabeth Warren. He's running on an economic populist agenda. You know, he's taken a lot of outside money from outside the state, so he's really kind of embracing that role as the outsider. And on the other hand, you have Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam, who's wrapped up pretty much every endorsement statewide, has a clear cash advantage when it comes to the race. So he's really the establishment candidate. And I think that sort of goes back to the same fight in 2016. We're reliving it in Virginia right now in 2017.
Well, you mentioned the Congressman Tom Perriello has all of these endorsements. The current Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam has, it seems, money behind ads. Let's listen to a little of one.
I'm Ralph Northam. And when survivors of the Virginia Tech shooting asked me to support an assault weapons ban and close the gun show loophole, I took on the fight. I saw what those weapons can do as an Army doctor during the Gulf War. Now, I'm listening carefully to Donald Trump, and I think he's a narcissistic maniac.
whatever you call
it. Okay,
them.
There.
right.
So we see Donald Trump, you know, an image of him in one ad, and on one candidate being called not Donald Trump enough in the Republican side,
right.
And then we have an anti-Trump here. But have, you know, Trump or previous President Obama, have they gotten involved? Have the parties kind of indicated, you said some, you know, party leaders have, but have parties kind of gotten into these races and picked a side?
Within the parties for the primaries, they're going to let them fight it out to sort of figure this out. You know, whichever side wins, when you look at the Democrats, I mean, that's going to be very telling to see how they're going to sort of approach politics moving forward. I mean, this is the first real big race before the 2018 midterms, this governor's race in Virginia. So I think whether, you know, you have some the more sort of progressive candidate or the more middle of the road establishment candidate is going to be telling to see which works right now with President Trump in the White House.
Patrick Madden, reporter at contributor station WAMU. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
For the first time ever, Bitcoin traded above $3,000 per coin over the weekend. It has more than tripled in value this year. And some analysts believe that the digital currency could hit $4,000 by the end of this year, which brings up the question of whether this is a bubble. Christopher Vecchio is senior currency strategist at Daily FX, which follows foreign exchange markets. Christopher, welcome back.
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me back.
And just to give people some context, last June, Bitcoin's price peaked at just $780. What's behind this rise?
There's definitely been wider optimism about businesses and consumers accepting cryptocurrency in general as a legitimate means of transaction. Just recently, Japan has legalized Bitcoin as a legitimate medium of transaction itself. We're noticing that there are higher trading volumes out of Asia. In fact, between Japan and Korea alone, they account for about 46% of all trading volume in Bitcoin right now. There's also been possible capital flight out of China as questions over the stability of their debt situation have arisen over the last several months. And so overall, you're seeing a confluence of factors lead to a very high increase in demand. Bitcoin.
And in general, and obviously this changes from day to day or month to month, are most people buying Bitcoin to use it or are they buying it as an investment?
I think they're buying it for both, but in the last several weeks, in the midst of this 8-week rally, Bitcoin has been used more as a speculative vehicle.
So therefore, is the prediction that Bitcoin will continue to rise in value?
I think it will continue to rise in value, particularly when you look at the underlying aspect of Bitcoin's system itself. It is a currency with a finite money supply. There can only be 21 million Bitcoin in circulation at its max. And so that's a real deflationary pressure that will boost the value of Bitcoin over time. You know, and there's also widespread adoption of the blockchain technology.
And blockchain, tell us what that means.
Blockchain is a distributed ledger that is used to maintain this list of records. It's a way to make sure that all of the transactions using Bitcoin are held in the public eye for record. And therefore, it ensures that you can't really counterfeit these currencies because all of them have a particular transaction tag to them when they are sent from one person to the other, and everyone can see them at any given time. You have the Linux Foundation's Hyperledger and the Enterprise Ethereum Alliance with these permission blockchains that allow large corporations like banks or financial institutions or retailers to use the blockchain as the underlying processing payment system. That's only going to grow further in the future given its promises as technology, as we've talked about on length before.
Well, you mentioned Ethereum. There's also Ripple out there. How are these other digital currencies doing compared to Bitcoin?
All these cryptocurrencies are having tremendous years. In fact, if you look at the total market cap for crypto right now, it's on approach to $100 billion overall. Bitcoin is only about $45 or $46 billion of that. So it's not like Bitcoin is the only tree out there in the forest. There are a lot of other cryptocurrencies that have a great deal of market value, several of them in the high billions of dollars.
Let's talk about how people are actually using Bitcoin, because we hear that they're being used in Venezuela and Russia right now, increasingly adopting it. What's going on there?
Well, you're finding Bitcoin use in two places. One, in these stable developed economies where you can use it for real things like for Overstock or Expedia or Dell. But you're also seeing it found popularity right now in these countries that are seeing political instability because there's a question over whether or not those actual currencies will retain purchasing power. So by transferring your funds into Bitcoin, you not only gain a frictionless transaction and a place to store your money that's not held within the country, but also you're gaining a medium of transaction that isn't seeing you lose purchasing power. So countries like Russia, Venezuela, even China to an extent, have seen increased flow into Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies in the last several weeks, which is surely a driving factor behind the recent rally.
Here in this country, the Securities and Exchange Commission rejected one major attempt to legitimize digital currencies in the U.S. It would have created an exchange-traded fund, or ETF, for Bitcoin. Now it's reviewing that decision. What do you expect there, and what kind of a difference would that make?
I think it's very possible that the SEC gives formal recognition of Bitcoin with an investment vehicle like an ETF. However, you know, the whole point of these cryptocurrencies is to stay deregulated, decentralized, away from governments themselves. And by having a government regulate a security attached to Bitcoin, it may actually dampen some of the true enthusiasm behind the cryptocurrency as a medium itself. But again, the blockchain is where the promise is at here. Overall, as long as we continue to see technological development and innovation along those lines, it's not going to dissuade anyone's interest over the long term.
So there are probably a lot of listeners who have never used Bitcoin and don't plan on ever using Bitcoin. Do you think they're going to be using Bitcoin at some point in the future? Are we going to start to see it replace regular currencies for people who aren't quite as advanced as those who are already in the Bitcoin marketplace?
So I don't think that we're going to ever abandon regular currency, but I do think that Bitcoin could be used in some of the underlying transaction processes that people make, say, with using their phones to send money to one another over a service like Venmo, or if you have a Chase QuickPay-like service. Those processes could be underpinned by the blockchain. And so, you know, there will be a point in time in the future where people may be using these peer-to-peer transaction services and not realize that they're actually using the Bitcoin blockchain.
That's Christopher Vecchio, a senior currency strategist at Daily FX. Christopher, thank you.
Thanks very much for having me again.
Well, when it comes to the ways animals communicate with each other, you might think we've got a pretty good handle on their methods. Birds sing, cats purr, dogs bark, cows moo. But new tools are allowing a group of scientists to listen into animal conversations that we didn't even know were happening before. Jason Moon from Here Now contributor New Hampshire Public Radio reports.
I'm inside a lab at the University of New Hampshire in Durham, New Hampshire, where master's student Mia Phillips is about to open up a little plastic container. It looks like it might be leftovers.
So careful, it kind of smells. There we go.
So this is a dead mouse?
Yeah, that's a dead mouse rolled up in a ball by two parent beetles.
So turns out it is leftovers, just not for us. It's for a pair of American burying beetles. Now, these bugs earn their name by working with a mate to bury small dead critters they find lying around. Then they lay their eggs near the carcass, which becomes baby food. And the reason Phillips is tending to a flock of hundreds of these beetles here in the lab is because she's trying to solve a riddle about how they communicate. See, when the beetles are burying a corpse, they seem to be talking. Phillips plays me a recording she made in the lab.
Yeah, so like the obvious question is like, what does that mean? Like, what are they saying?
That's a difficult enough question already, but there's a twist. Burying beetles are deaf. So why would they make a noise that they can't even hear?
I've got an embroidery hoop with nylon stretch over it, which is really just pantyhose.
In another part of the lab, Philip shows me a contraption that will test her hypothesis that the beetles aren't so much talking with each other as they are vibrating with each other. It's a laser vibrometer. It can detect minute vibrations, and it's aimed at a small patch of pantyhose. Phillips puts a beetle on the pantyhose. She uses a miniature leash to keep it from wandering off. And then the laser converts any vibrations it detects into an audio signal that humans can hear. It's the first time anyone has ever done this with this species.
What we've discovered is that there's a whole world of communication taking place that we've been entirely unaware of it.
That's Dan Howard. He's a professor of biology at the University of New Hampshire who oversees this research. And he says there are a lot of firsts happening in this field of vibrational animal communication right now. That's because the lasers that are required to listen in have only recently become affordable for most labs. And now that scientists can eavesdrop on the insects, Howard says it's a little like Horton hears a who. That's the Dr. Seuss book, where Horton, the elephant, is the first creature in the jungle to hear the tiny whoos that live on a speck of dust.
He was splashing, enjoying the jungle's great joys, when Horton the elephant heard a small noise.
And that makes Howard and the grad students who study with him a bit like Horton. And there's plenty more for them to hear. Scientists estimate there are millions of insect species using vibrational communications, and they've only just begun to catalog them.
We could probably go out into College Wood in the summer, once all the insects are out and active, and find some small leafhopper or thornhopper and record it and be the first person to have ever done that for that particular species.
The insect vibrations that scientists have described suggest that a whole new soundscape is just waiting to be discovered. Take, for instance, the jumping spider. Biologists think that's part of the spider's complex mating ritual. Then there's the tree hopper, an insect similar to a cicada that looks like a little leaf. It sends vibrations like this through the stem of a plant. Now that scientists are clued into this hidden world, it's raising all sorts of questions and possible applications. For instance, one of Phillips' experiments is designed to figure out if vibrational noise from a wind turbine could interfere with the burying beetle's communication. In Italy, researchers are trying to use vibrations to deter pest insects from feeding on vineyards. But beyond the practical applications, just knowing that the insects communicate like this might change how we feel about them. Because once you know that they can talk, they start to seem just a little more like a person. And, after all,
a person's a person, no matter how small.
Thanks, Horton. For Here and Now, I'm Jason Moon.
Missouri's Republican Governor Eric Greitens has called state lawmakers back to a special session today in Jefferson City to address regulations regarding abortion, including one in St. Louis. St. Louis has a traditional anti-discrimination ordinance banning discrimination based on race or gender, but the city added a ban on discrimination by employers and landlords against women who've chosen an abortion. Joe Manis is the political reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Joe, why did St. Louis do this? Was there discrimination against women who'd had an abortion?
Well, there's no major cases that I'm aware of, but I think the feeling was that with the climate being pretty tense around the abortion issue in Missouri, that the perception was among the Board of Aldermen that they wanted to do something to make clear that the anti-discrimination was broader than maybe what some would think, that it's not just race or sexual identity. They wanted to include this as well. There's a couple other areas of the country where they have done something similar, although Missouri's ordinance is believed to be the broadest.
Well, your state is a state with a part-time legislature, and we know it was other Republican lawmakers in the state who pushed your governor to call this part-time legislature back into special session. What's been the response?
Well, it's mixed. The General Assembly is heavily Republican. They have a two-thirds majority in both chambers. So the expectation is that this will pass. There is many Republicans who share the governor's concern about abortion. But there are some who are a little disturbed because this bill, there were several bills related to abortion, as they are every session, that were going along this session, died at the end for procedural reasons. But the point being that the governor really was not heavily involved in this bill or others. And then since the General Assembly went out of session, he's been focusing on various issues. And this is our second special session. And this is pretty much unprecedented territory in Missouri. Generally, there's just only one special session, if that. And the governor usually has signaled well ahead of time because they were upset over something that happened or didn't happen during the regular session.
Well, and this special session, we know the governor also wants to look at adding more regulations to abortion clinics. As more clinics are set to open in the next few months in the state, so some regulations may make it more difficult for them to operate or impossible. But talk about his wanting to roll back this anti-discrimination ordinance, or this portion of it having to do with abortion in St. Louis. Can he do that? Because it feels a little like the anti-sanctuary city moves we've seen, for instance, in Texas.
Well, in fact, some of the opponents of this ordinance expansion refer to St. Louis as a sanctuary city when it comes to abortion. Now, one of the reasons is because generally speaking, the city of St. Louis is the only city in the state that has an abortion clinic. There has been one in Columbia, Missouri, which is in the center of the state, that's been sometimes operating and sometimes not. It hasn't been operating for the last couple of years. Planned Parenthood, which is based in St. Louis, and there's also a chapter in Kansas City, and they operate their clinic on the other side of the border in Kansas. Because of the federal judge's ruling in April, which tossed out a bunch of longstanding Missouri restrictions as a result of the Supreme Court ruling in the Texas case, both Planned Parenthood affiliates expect to open between 2 and 4 new clinics within the next few months. And that's what's really generated a lot of this angst among abortion opponents.
That's Joe Manis, political reporter for St. Louis Public Radio, talking about this special session the governor has called in that state. Joe, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Question, who are today's up-and-coming stand-up comics? We started thinking about that because of the new Showtime TV series from executive producer Jim Carrey, I'm Dying Up Here. It's about several young comics in the 70s trying to get their big break.
You want to go on The Tonight Show?
Yes.
Let me help you. Mm-hmm. Find a voice that women can relate to.
I have a voice women
can relate to. It sheds light on our mutual experiences, huh? Then I'll put you on the main stage, front and center. My right hand to Carson.
Is Kaufman like Carly? Is Klein like Pryor?
You're missing my point.
Yeah, they're all up there on your stage. Why is it any different for women? There is room for me, too. I just need your stage to prove it.
When you're ready.
A scene from I'm Dying Up Here, the fictional TV show about the 70s. But Rolling Stone has a list of the funniest 50 people right now, so we thought we'd take a look at that with Rob Sheffield, who wrote it. He joins us now. And Rob, just 50? Have you heard from the other 10,000?
Comedy is booming right now. It's really amazing. We're at a point where comedy is like the new rock and roll.
It has exploded. How did you choose these 50 comedians?
Well, we had a lot of arguments, a lot of very fun arguments in the office, a lot of debates, a lot of throwing names around. People are very loyal. One of the beautiful things about comedy, even more than music, tastes are absolutely personal. You know, you love what you love.
Well, you have the top tier, Louis C.K., Chris Rock, Kate McKinnon from Saturday Night Live, Jordan Peele and Keegan-Michael Key. But in that top tier, I'm sure there's one that everyone agrees on. This is Melissa McCarthy. You write that her Sean Spicer press conferences on Saturday Night Live are a weekly reason to go on living. Here she is. Remember, she's in her little man outfit at her press podium.
Begin today by apologizing on behalf of you to me for how you have treated me these last 2 weeks. And that apology is not accepted. Because I'm not here to be your buddy. I'm here to swallow gum, and I'm here to take Nate.
And Rob Sheffield, you know, she is very funny anyway, but every now and then a comic just steps into a puddle of gold.
Absolutely. It's a case where the right comedian at the right moment, you know, our nation needed her and she stepped into that void.
Staying with SNL, we want to listen to the legendary Dave Chappelle, who did an opening. But remind us, he took a break from comedy, walked away from his own show and $50 million. I mean, it was astonishing.
One of the most legendary moves any comedian ever made is him just walking away from that show and that huge pile of money. He's a different guy, and part of what really works about his new specials, he just dropped 2 specials on Netflix that were recorded, you know, almost a year apart, and they're very different kinds of stuff. He's not recycling his greatest hits. He's an older guy. He's a richer guy. He's a more confused guy. So in some ways, he's really confused by the world around him, and he's kind of feeling it out as he goes along, which is part of what's exhilarating is he's on the edge of the moment.
Yeah. Let's listen to a little of his opening monologue for SNL last November.
If someone threatened our president, that is the only time that I'd want him to be stereotypically black. We'd be on the news like an assassination attempt was carried out today on the United States president in a bizarre sequence of events. The president himself was armed, fired back, killing 4 people that had nothing to do with the incident. He then ripped off his shirt, screamed out Chi-Town for some reason.
Him being on SNL, that's probably the cleanest, non-bleeped Dave Chappelle we could do.
Well, that's a case where this is a stand-up who, you know, walked away from his weekly TV platform, came back doing stand-up rather than the sketches that he was doing on his show. But he has so many options now because there's so much flexibility in terms of the platforms. I mean, it's funny, the clip that you were showing from I'm Dying Up Here, which is comedy in the early 70s when it was all about a five-minute shot on The Tonight Show and there were only three networks and such a tiny little window to get through if you were going to have a comedy career. Now there's all these different platforms. There's streaming, there's specials, there's social media.
Well, in continuing with your categories, Patton Oswalt is another comic you put in the category of the legends. Let's listen to a bit from him.
Because Star Wars was my first and final realm. This, you know, that thing where it's a thing you get into so that you know the whole world as if you live in it. Like, I knew all of the connections and the, you know, back and forth. I don't know why they didn't, like, have me go to terminal wards on hospitals where, like, patients, like, don't want to let go of life and just let me talk to them about Star Wars. They would have flatlined after 30 seconds. And, you know, Dengar's ship was called the Punishing One, and it's interesting how it's also a converted Corellian. Beep!
You know, very funny. But about a year ago, we learned that Patton Oswalt had a very tragic personal loss.
Patton Oswalt, he's so beloved because he's always been such a soulful voice in comedy. He's always talked about his life, you know, his lonely bachelor days, and he used to do routines when, you know, he was meeting his wife and the early days of his marriage and becoming a dad. And then when he and his daughter went through that horrible tragedy a year ago when suddenly and unexpectedly his wife died, that Patton Oswalt was able to respond to that by going back to work and respond to it in such a brave and open and honest way. It really kind of shows a lot about sort of how emotionally complex comedy is in 2017.
Now, this is his wife, Michelle McNamara. So something that maybe tore open a part of Patton Oswalt there. And again, in the Legends category, he shares that in your mind with Trey Parker and Matt Stone, Larry David, Carl Reiner.
Carl Reiner is amazing. From the golden age of comedy, nobody has adapted to Twitter as gleefully as Carl Reiner. It's a really beautiful thing that he and Mel Brooks, still BFFs after all these years, they still hang out and watch TV together every night. These are guys who've had entire careers, entire legends behind them. And Carl Reiner is on Twitter all the time making rude jokes about the political situation in a way that's very bracing. We should all be as tough as this guy.
So he's all the rage now on Twitter. Let's go back to your today's stand-ups, including Aparna Nancherla. She had a great debut album on Tig Notaro's label. She's got a web series, podcast. Let's listen to a little of her stand-up.
So one thing that I've never been able to get on board with is that there are just, like, models walking around all the time, just, like, unregulated, just, like, feral models wandering the streets that nobody warns you about. Models, to me, feel like self-esteem pickpockets. Like, they're fine at a distance, but then you directly walk by one, and you're just like, no. I have nothing. Even my personality is the wrong shape.
Rob, she's one of only four that you picked, with Hannibal Buress, Ali Wong, Chris Gethard. What is it about Aparna that you like?
Going around the hoops that one would have had to jump to have a comedy career in the old days, now she's able to sort of build things using her own formats.
What's next? Like, is there some form of comedy that you see on the horizon out there?
Well, it's funny what a circumscribed world it used to be. And again, it's really interesting to watch that I'm Dying Up Here show and see how constricted it was in the 70s when there was such a relatively narrow set of rules and such a relatively narrow avenue that comedians had to break through to the mainstream audience. Now the barriers are just falling down and people keep finding ways to use podcasts, to use web series, to use different social media channels just to find their audience. You just do your stuff and your people find you. It's a beautiful time for comedy.
That's Rob Sheffield, his piece, The 50 Funniest People Right Now in Rolling Stone. We'll link it here now.org. He's also author of the new book, Dreaming the Beatles. Rob, thank you.
Thank you so much.
So many great comics on his list. Ali Wong, writer for Fresh Off the Boat, she has that great line, you got to make a guy think your body is a secret garden when really it's a public park that's hosted reggae fests. Derek Waters, who gets celebrities drunk then has them read history. Melissa Broder has the Twitter account So Sad Today. Mark Maron does his podcast out of a garage. Tell us your favorites as we go out with Hannibal Buress. He tells a story of shopping with his girlfriend. They're so excited about buying tons of apple juice. But the clerk just shakes his head.
But it took me a minute to realize he wasn't shaking his head because of the apple juice. He was shaking his head because my girlfriend was white and he didn't agree with that. But I was so caught up in the euphoria of having all that apple juice that for like a minute I lived in a world where racism didn't exist. I was like, it's obvious that this old man is just an apple juice hater. And he's just really mad because he can't acquire all the apple juice. But I'm a crying right now. Hey, thanks a lot, y'all.
Another Uber executive is leaving the company. Emil Michael, a senior vice president, made an announcement to staff today, according to Recode. And Uber's board is reportedly weighing a leave of absence for CEO and co-founder Travis Kalanick as part of a broader shakeup to try to improve company culture. The board voted unanimously over the weekend to adopt a range of recommendations about Uber's corporate culture that came from former Attorney General Eric Holder. The company has been facing accusations that it doesn't take sexual harassment, discrimination, or bullying seriously. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
So we don't yet know exactly what the recommended changes are from this Holder report that the board voted to adopt, but what was the investigation focused on?
Focused on sexual harassment, focused on sexism, on a broken corporate culture that encourages employees to skirt laws and treat their fellow colleagues poorly and do anything to improve the bottom line. It is trying to get to the bottom of one of the more public and infamous sort of corporate culture blowups that we've seen in recent memory. And this was all triggered by a blog post. Former Uber engineer Susan Fowler wrote a blog post that was detailing sexism and harassment that she faced at the company. This created a firestorm. It prompted this investigation into the company's work culture, and it is targeting even Travis Kalanick and his behavior as boss. And it's just remarkable because this is in addition to a criminal probe that Uber faces over software used to evade authorities. It's in addition to a lawsuit from Google's self-driving car division over stolen technology. Just an enormous amount of negative news swirling right now about Uber.
And yet the Ubers are still driving all over the place and people are taking them.
Yes, they are. I'm still taking them, right, when I use Lyft and Uber about equally. The company itself seems to be showing significantly growing revenue. We don't yet – last time it was valued about $70 billion, one of the highest valuations ever for a private company, an incredible corporate accomplishment. There's no doubt about that. It is a remarkable company from a bottom line perspective, a revenue perspective. But, you know, these issues go right to the heart of Uber's talent. And any company is only as good as its people. And Uber is losing people left and right from the top to the bottom. You have executives leaving. You have Kalanick facing a possible leave. You have attrition at the bottom, people leaving the company because they feel like it's a sinking ship. It is really a crisis, a cultural crisis, the likes of which we just haven't seen in recent memory in Silicon Valley.
Well, let's talk about Travis Kalanick because he has been at the center of this story all along. And as you say, we're waiting to find out if he's going to be asked to take a leave right now. But are there good and bad things about Travis Kalanick? Is there a reason he's been able to hold on this long, despite the fact that we and others have been doing stories about all the turmoil at Uber for weeks and months?
Culture starts at the top, for good and for bad. Kalanick is clearly an entrepreneurial genius, an operational genius. He has built a $70 billion company, at least in terms of its last valuation, that has had to compete in an incredibly crowded marketplace. You know, I live in New York. People listening might be living in Boston, Austin, Seattle, all over the country. There are so many options to drive around, taxis, your own car, and yet Uber has thrived in this incredibly crowded atmosphere. That is an incredible statement of its corporate genius. But at the same time, that genius has been built on a culture that is clearly sick in some way. You have a culture where sexual harassment seems to be rampant, where women don't feel comfortable working for the company. And it took this blog post to sort of shine a bright light on that fact. And so from the top to the bottom, I think it's fair to say that Kalanick is responsible, even if he didn't necessarily know about all these incidences. He sets the tone for his company.
company, and he's responsible as much for its successes as for its corporate widespread failures.
Well, and we have to think of the parallels here between what's happening at Uber and what just happened at Fox News, or what is happening at Fox News, where you also had a lot of allegations of sexual harassment, but in the end, Roger Ailes had to go. He has since passed away, but he had to go, and Kalanick is at the moment still there.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, in many ways, Fox News and Uber, you know, are nothing alike, right? They're in completely different industries. But at the same time, they're both interesting examples of how a high-flying company can be absolutely brought down by issues of corporate culture. And that it's not just a matter of, you know, one woman's story or one man's story. That when you hear of a single incident, a little bit of smoke, there seems to be a conflagration underneath it. That, you know, people looking into Fox News have realized that the sexual harassment allegations were much more widespread than a single person's testimony. Same thing with Uber, that it's not just a single blog post. It's not just one or two features or stories. It's something that's happening culture-wide. And ironically, I think it's important to point out that there's a difference between a great startup culture and a great CEO culture. And it's possible that many of the attributes that made Uber revered and so successful when it was an upstart, like a disregard for established rules and a mentality that's all about kind of a loosey-goosey frat culture that was right. attractive to a lot of programmers at the beginning, are now all hamstringing the company today.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.